720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you spending part of your Saturday with me. I hope you are staying warm and dry. We will keep you updated as all the weather changes throughout the day, of course, as ever. Lots to do on the Wintrust Business Lunch today. We have lots and lots of things to cover, lots and lots of things to talk about. But one very, very big business story that was all over the place this week that I think is so fascinating is this Wells Fargo story. Essentially, as you've probably heard, a lot of Wells Fargo employees were opening accounts, bank accounts, savings accounts, checking accounts, credit card accounts, all the kinds of accounts under their customers' names without them knowing. They were fraudulently doing so, and it is really widespread. So Wells Fargo has fired about 5,000 employees as a result of this. It's just really, really an interesting story. Joining us now on the phone is Helene Olin. She's a columnist for Slate and co-author of The Index Card. Hi, Helene. Welcome back to the program.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chicago.
Well, so this is really quite a story that I think nobody saw coming from Wells Fargo, that suddenly, it's such an unprecedented and bizarre story, too, that 5,000 employees were doing this, that this was so widespread, this practice. What insight do you have into that?
Well, this has been actually brewing for some time. It's just that it really hadn't broken out into mainstream attention. In 2013, the Los Angeles Times did an investigative piece about Wells Fargo. And all of these allegations were in it about it was an extreme high-pressure sales culture in which employees would essentially be threatened with firing if they did not keep up with sales quotas. And the LA Times at the time quoted people as saying they would be sent to McDonald's, for instance, if they could not keep up. So the result is that people, employees, seem to open up ghost accounts, fake bank accounts, fake credit cards. What the Los Angeles Times did not even realize is that the numbers totaled millions. There was over 1 million bank accounts involved across the country and over 500,000 credit card applications across the country. So after that, the Los Angeles Times county attorney filed suit against Wells Fargo, and from there it piqued the attention of the CFPB. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau arranged the settlement that was announced this week, which is the largest, by the way, in the Bureau's five-year history. The Bureau is getting $100 million from Wells, and the L.A. County office and another federal department are splitting another $85 million.
It's really, really unbelievable. I mean, it seems like it's made up. It seems like fiction. So what is the impact on consumers? Because I know there were customers who tried to attempt, they tried to get, some legal action started about this, and it was largely dismissed. Wells Fargo fought back, and it was, pretty widely dismissed. So what was the financial impact on the consumer?
We don't still know that. Wells Fargo is claiming that the vast majority of consumers saw no losses or very minimal losses, maybe $25. However, again, Wells Fargo is aggressively fighting these lawsuits. There is at least one celebrity, a Mexican singer named Ana Barbera, who is alleging that employees did this to her and not only opened a fake bank account for her, they drained over $400,000 from her account from her legitimate account. And she's suing, and Wells Fargo is fighting back, saying, well, you didn't notify us within 60 days of the fraud.
Wow.
So there is definitive allegations of identity theft going on here as well. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's quite possible that some of these credit cards have resulted in damage to people's credit scores. We don't really know. What I would say the bigger picture is this is just yet another knock in the reputation of the banks. People don't trust the banks. They don't think the banks are looking out for their interests. They think the banks are corrupt. You know the story. And this is yet another instance where the bank blames a bunch of low-level employees for what happened, and nobody in the C-suite seems to suffer.
Right. And that's something you point out in the piece that you wrote for Slate recently about how rot begins at the top, as you put it, right? That a lot of employees were dismissed over this, about 5,000 of them. But as far as we know at this point, none of them were C-suite level. None of them were leadership. And that does point to a troubling, a troubling notion and a troubling trend, really, that if leadership allowed this, then that leadership should be accountable. And yet it's being, the punishment is being dealt to the lower level employees.
Right. It defies reason to think that all these employees came up with essentially the same scheme on their own, right? Mm-hmm. But secondarily, there's become this sort of thought out there in the past 24 hours is that it was low-level employees just sort of trying to scam a commission. And that, you know, the bank was so too big to manage, basically, right, as opposed to too big to fail. Now, it's quite possible Wells Fargo is indeed too big to manage, but this scandal doesn't point in that direction. What this scandal points to is the fact that nobody wanted to crack down on this. The fact is the Los Angeles Times did this article in 2013. I would imagine that if you are the CEO of Wells Fargo, you probably have a really good idea if a major metropolitan newspaper does an investigative piece on you saying this.
Right.
So by definition, they had to know they had a major problem by 2013. And the fact is, as we know, they were fighting all of these lawsuits and demanding that people go to mandatory arbitration. You know how you sign that contract when you open up an account that says, you know, you'll agree to arbitration. Even if, by the way, they didn't know they had opened the account. So they were holding them to these agreements. And the courts were backing Wells Fargo up. I mean, this is just an absolute disgrace. And there is no way anybody could say they did not have an inkling of how bad it was.
It is a really fascinating story with just so many twists and turns to it. But we will keep turning to you for the latest on this. I think the fine part is really interesting. It's $185 million in fines. $100 million of that goes to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It'll be really interesting how this continues to shake out. I think you bring up some really excellent points. So everybody head to slate.com and read this story by our good friend, Helene Olin. Thanks so much for joining us today, Helene.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and we come back. We are talking about a really interesting initiative happening right here in Chicago connected to farming and urban farming. It's very, very cool. We'll be right back in just a bit to talk that over here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you spending part of your Saturday with us. I know you have many, many options, lots to do. And indeed, we have lots to do here on the show today. We are, you know, anybody who's listening to this show regularly knows that I really, really so very interested in urban agriculture. I think that's so important. And I think it's important that we know where our food comes from and that we eat healthy food and that everybody has access to healthy food. And so that's a topic that we talk about a lot on this show. And joining us now by phone is our good friend, Greg Trotter, who's the business reporter who covers the food industry at Chicago Tribune. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Welcome back to the show. Always a pleasure to have you on with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So very, very interesting story happening right now, and that is this $1 million USDA urban farming grant that Chicago has just been awarded. That sounds very, very interesting. Tell us about what all that entails.
That's right. Yeah. So this grant was part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Conservation Innovation Grants. So there were 45 awarded nationally, a total of $26.6 million, and Chicago got $1 million of that for an urban farming project. Most of these grants are, you know, they're environmental conservation grants, and they're mostly in more rural areas. Some of them did go to cities such as Chicago and Cleveland, Detroit, Richmond, Virginia for urban farming grants. Chicago's, I mean, as you mentioned, there's been sort of a recent urban farming movement here in Chicago. We've seen various businesses and nonprofits move in, and this has become increasingly popular. And so this is the city of Chicago trying to pull some of those resources, build what they call a cohort-based model. They want to recruit and train farmers. They want to provide technical assistance and micro grants to already established farmers. And there's a part of the grant as well is there's going to be a new full-time urban agriculture coordinator for the city of Chicago.
Which I think that is really, really interesting because that's really such a big piece of it is the ability to make a living working in sustainable agriculture. I think there's so many people that are forced to kind of just do it as a hobby or do it as part of another business. You know, I know there's a lot of restaurants who you have like rooftop farming and things like that, but it really isn't the focus. It's just sort of supplemental to produce they're ordering from elsewhere. So I think that part is really, really interesting that it's becoming more and more viable to make a living in urban farming here.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. And you have farms that have moved in, operations like Gotham Greens and Pullman, Out in Rochelle, was still considered Chicago area in terms of urban farming anyway, Mighty Vine Tomatoes and Bright Farms, which sells to Mariano's. But, you know, these are operations that, you know, they sell to upscale grocers and they sell to, you know, fine dining restaurants in Chicago. And so it's you know, I think what excites the USDA about these types of grants and what Chicago is trying to do is, okay, you know, this is a foodie movement. People want locally grown food, but how do you sort of, you know, also have this be something that can be, you know, provide jobs in neighborhoods that desperately need them and be a source of economic development. So it's not just people shopping at Whole Foods that are eating or, you know, buying locally grown tomatoes. It can actually be something that helps some of Chicago's low-income neighborhoods.
Right. And so I'm very interested in what you mentioned in the story that you wrote about this at ChicagoTribune.com. I'm very, very interested in the repurposing of the abandoned railway area that runs through Inglewood. That seems like that is kind of one part where this grant might be making some impact, because that land has been prepared for farming is what it seems like.
Yeah, no, that fascinated me as well. I mean, so for years we've been hearing that, you know, Inglewood could have a rail trail, sort of like the 606 or the Bloomingdale Trail on the north side. There's been, and I think the fact that the 606 opened to such rave reviews, and it's, you know, by most accounts been a popular and well-received thing, that, you know, it sort of reignited the calls for something like that in Inglewood on the south side. And so this would be a really interesting component of that. The city, I talked to Chris Wheat, who is the chief sustainability officer for Chicago, and he said that the city owns or is in the process of acquiring a lot of the land along the Inglewood Trail. And so part of this grant and part of their match, it's a matching grant program, they're going to continue to the environmental remediation of the land near the Inglewood Trail for farming purposes. And eventually that land could be placed into a trust and then could be leased or rented to farmers. So, I mean, that could be certainly a pretty, you know, interesting piece of what becomes the Inglewood Rail Trail. And it also just seems to be a sign that the city is perhaps, you know, moving forward and with that idea. I asked Chris, you know, when are we going to hear more about the Inglewood Trail? And he said that he thought that there was going to be some announcements next year.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, very
we'll
interesting.
See.
So what is there a downside to this? Are there critics to this? Or is this something that most people are buying into in the city? Most people feel pretty good about this.
Or well, is it, I mean,
hard
I,
to
I
say.
Could see,
thoughtful pause
yeah,
there.
I mean, well, I could see, you know, some critics saying, you know, it because it is a matching grant, is this the best way for the city to spend its resources or what have you? There's not going to be a separate budget line item for the city, you know, ponying up finances for this. It's more through their what they call in-kind staff time and through this land remediation process that they're doing.
Yeah.
So that's their match. So we'll see. I mean, I think the big question is, will it have a meaningful impact in terms of economic development in an area like Inglewood?
Right.
Or is it, you know, it can just continue to sort of feed the foodie movement?
Sure. Right. I think that part is really interesting, because at some point it is about, you know, class and access, you know, it gets to that part really, really quickly and easily. So what are the other things that we may be able to see that this grant will touch and improve in addition to possibly this Inglewood area?
Well, I mean, I think the details, more details will come. I mean, it sounds like from what we've heard, they're going to try to coordinate with the various nonprofits like Windy City Harvest, which is through the Chicago Botanic Garden. They do trainings and apprenticeships of urban farming. Another nonprofit is Growing Power. So Chris Wheat mentioned both of those nonprofits as possible partners for this grant. So I guess we'll see how it all plays out. I mean, what they said is, you know, they're going to be preparing this land near the Inglewood Trail. They're going to be recruiting farmers and training them. And so I imagine they would certainly call on, you know, some of these, you know, nonprofits that actually know how to farm to do that training,
right?
And to partner with for that part of the process. And he did say that, you know, that in terms of their recruitment of farmers, it's not just going to be from the Inglewood area. They want to bring people from all over Chicago, but it would be some from Inglewood and some of the surrounding neighborhoods there. So
interesting. Such an interesting topic. I think urban agriculture is just such an interesting topic. And the food systems and food justice is just so important. I think, you know, that's why we talk about it so much on this show. It's so very interesting and surprisingly complex when you start breaking it all down and looking at all the moving parts of it. So appreciate you doing what you're doing. And thanks for talking to us about it today. Greg Trotter from Chicago Tribune.
Okay. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks very much. Talk to you next time. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff and be right back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday with me. Sitting here in the beautiful Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue, and the sun has just come out, and everyone keeps looking up and smiling. It's very exciting. People are like, wait, I didn't expect to see the sun today. We like it. We'll take it. Our February selves will thank us for enjoying the sunshine now. Still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Many, many things to talk about. Among them, the very interesting list from our friends at Crane's Chicago Business has come out that lists out the 100 most connected business people in Chicago, which is an interesting way to put it. And so here to talk with us about that is our good friend Jan Parr. Hi, Jan. Welcome back to the program.
Hi.
How are you today?
Not bad, thanks.
Great. So this list is very interesting. Of course, me being me, the first thing that jumps out at me when I look at the top 20 is I think there's only one woman on there, but that's not surprising. I think those are things that we already know. But what about this list? You know, it's such a nebulous term anyway, the most connected. That's so hard to qualify. So what was that process of kind of assembling these people for this list?
Right. Well, unlike many of the lists that Crane's puts out during the year, you know, we do 40 under 40 and 20 in their 20s. We do the who's who, which is also in this same issue. Those are done by nominations and by us doing a lot of editorial research and a lot of hashing out among the editors to decide who's on it. The most connected is purely a data project. We worked with a technology company called Relationship Science, and we sort of fed in thousands of numbers of business people in Chicago to see how they're connected through nonprofit boards, through corporate boards, through the economic club, and we were really looking for how they connect other people and what sort of influence they wield and what sort of reach they have and how they are able to connect unconnected people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah. So we were surprised by some of the results as well.
Well, that was my very next question, is what stood out is really surprising to you, and what did you not see coming at all as you were creating this and putting this data together?
Well, some of the biggest names you're not going to see on here. You're not going to see politicians who, you know, may have gone into business as consultants, such as Richie Daley, Jim Thompson. There's no Rocky Wirtz. There's no Rich Melman. There's no Pat Ryan. There's no Margie Korshak, a very well-known PR person in town, because partially they may not participate on many nonprofit boards. Some people, CEOs of well-known companies, are new to town. Being connected sort of is a byproduct of being in Chicago for a long time. And that's also why you'll see mostly older people on this list, including our number one most connected, Lester Crown. who is 91 and so has a lot of connections.
Right, right. That is an interesting piece of it, that the, you know, those roots run deep and those relationships really matter. And I think that's really what's at the crux of this, is that we talk about, you know, money and class and access, and we talk about even, you know, digital access to people and social media networks and net worth and all those things. But at the end of the day, this is really boiling down to relationships that are built and how people connect to other people.
Yes, that's right. And then how, and most of those people, in particular Lester Crown, use those connections to get things done. Mm-hmm. You know, he can snap his fingers and say, please donate some money to this cause, and it'll happen. And the Crown family has, you know, he leads by example. They've donated $2 million to the Art Institute this year, last year $10 million to the Chicago Council to fund fellowships. So, yeah, he uses his connections for sure.
Right. And so what trends did you notice on this? Maybe something, you know, surprising or new or through lines that maybe don't seem obvious at first glance of this list?
I am not sure. I don't know that everyone would know or not know that Northwestern University is the most connected educational institution. So of the 100 people on our list, there were 31 connections going through Northwestern. And by that, we don't mean that people were necessarily graduates or undergraduates, but that they are related to the board of Northwestern.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And the whole notion of how active a board should be is getting to be more interesting these days, you know, as people are talking about safe spaces and trigger warnings and core curriculum and what students. So these connected people are stepping up to have, I'd say, a more powerful role.
Right. And when you talk about boards, was there an average number of boards that you saw people on? Were most people focusing on one big cause, or did they tend to spread it out amongst, you know, around a couple of boards?
Yeah, yeah. All the 100 on our list are on multiple boards for sure. Yeah, one will not cut it. Whereas, you know, on our who's who list, you know, of people you should know, you know, you may have a powerful person at the helm of a company, but that may be all that person does.
Right.
But, yeah, these people are on multiple boards, and probably they're on the Economic Club of Chicago, mm-hmm. Which is the most connected board by a long shot. At least 56 people from our 100 are members of the Economic Club.
Very interesting. That's super interesting.
Yeah.
What about industries? Were there any industries that seemed to stand out more or be better represented on this list than others?
Well, certainly for women, the 16 women on our list, most of them are in finance, which may or may not be surprising. But finance actually shows up in a pretty big way throughout this list of 100.
Very, very interesting. I love these kind of lists that you guys do at Cranes. I think they're so interesting. And I love to just kind of look at them and look at all the people on them. And I think they're so, so very interesting. But this one in particular, I thought was interesting because what an interesting term, that most connected business people. But I really love that this really does boil down to relationships, because at the end of the day, I think, you know, a great thing about any industry that, you know, if you build a reputation as being a big old jerk, you're just only going to get so far, you know. And I think, you know, that says like kindness matters and relationships matter, and I think that's something we lose sight of often in business, and we look at it just kind of the bottom line. But I really like that this is all about relationship building at its finest.
Right, right. Because you're not going to get very far on these boards by not getting along with other people, that's for sure.
Right. And I think, too, about being generous, about connecting people. I think that's so very important. And, you know, I think it's like a moral imperative. If I know that you're working on something and somebody else I know is working on it, well, I think I have a moral obligation to connect you. You know, I think some people kind of, there are two camps of people, right? There's the connector people, and then there's the, I don't want to, you know, diminish something I'm doing by connecting someone else. So I think there's kind of two schools of thought. It's very interesting. And it seems like the people who are connecting more people and putting those people together seem to rise, which there's hope for me yet, because I'd like to think I'm a connector. So excellent.
Good.
Jan Parr, Assistant Managing Editor of Cranes Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you next time. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are answering a very important question, and that is connected to your bucket list. How much would you pay for these once-in-a-lifetime opportunities? Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is suddenly, when we started the show, it was kind of gloomy outside, but now it's sunny and beautiful. So I hope you're enjoying a little of the sunshine today at some point. Our February selves will thank us, as I like to say. We got to get that sunshine while we can here. My friends, I have a question for you, and that is, what would you be willing to pay for one of those once in a lifetime experiences? You know, the credit card commercials say, you know, this thing is priceless, and other credit cards say it gives you VIP access to things, right? What's that dollar amount where you're like, that's going to have to stay on my bucket list for a little bit longer? Here's why I ask. There's a story up at the New York Times, newyorktimes.com, and it's really all about a Cubs fan. And so StubHub data from last year, when they made the National League Championship Series, StubHub, they started selling tickets to game one of the World Series at Wrigley Field. And they ended up refunding all of that money when the Mets beat the Cubs and went to the World Series themselves. But not before they got a pretty good idea of what Cubs fans were willing to pay. So the lowest price anybody paid for a ticket, ready? $2,344. The average was just a little bit over $3,000. That's a lot. So it makes us think, what would I be willing to pay for those once in a lifetime things? Immediately, someone who comes to mind is someone who's been on this station many times as a guest, and that's Jeremy Shuey. He's connected to Riot Fest and Do312. I had him on the show when the Royals were in the World Series because he was looking for a ticket. He wanted to take his dad, and he said he was willing to tattoo a unicorn on his rear end if he got World Series tickets. And I think it worked. I don't know that he got the tattoo, but he certainly got the tickets because I remember seeing him post that on Facebook. People are willing to go to great lengths to do interesting things and get things off their bucket list. I think especially when it's connected to, giving that to someone else. Like, I think that was the deal. He wanted to take his dad to the World Series because he's a Royals fan.
Yeah, there's a story in this piece about two adult children of an elderly man who's a lifelong Cubs fan, going in on a ticket for him together.
Oh, how could you not?
Yeah.
You know.
And that, I think that did raise the amount they were willing to pay by a lot because it was for him.
Right. It's one thing to do it for yourself.
Important to note, I was a little hesitant to send this story along because it's not, in the minds of a lot of Cubs fans, it's not right to talk this way during the regular season.
Oh.
You don't want to jinx, obviously.
Right.
I approach this with some trepidation, but I think the question is interesting, not just about the Cubs, but about anything.
It's bigger than the Cubs. It's what you'd be willing to pay.
Good to lead off with that story from last year where they, of course, did not make the World Series. So we're not saying anything's going to happen.
Oh, no.
But
you're
just
really
saying.
Worried about your life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't like to talk this way.
I know,
but
I know.
It was an interesting story to me. So, yeah, I think if you're going in on it for someone else, that'll raise the price you're willing to pay if you're, a very generous person, I guess.
Sure. I mean, so what about you, Griffin? Like, what's on your list of stuff you pay?
I
mean,
I was trying to think.
It's a pretty
short list.
What have you got?
I don't know. I was thinking, I think for a lot of people, something like this, if you're not a sports fan, it'd be like reunion tour or final tour of some band that you're into. But
sure.
It's interesting to see those come and go. And then there's another reunion tour a couple of years later.
Right.
And you feel like you got... you wasted your money on the last one, but
sure, that's fair.
But I can't think of a band that I care enough to, go $3,000. It also just depends on the person. What is it for you? I don't know.
I mean, mine are not that big of a ticket. I mean, I really want to be in a shark cage. You can accomplish that for a few $100. I don't think it's like, thousands of dollars. Bob Kessler, what about you? What's on your bucket list? What would you pay for it?
I would not do a shark cage. I like trains. I want to take a train trip across Canada or Europe or something, and that'd be kind of cool.
There is an interesting thing that Amtrak does. I don't know if you've ever read about this. Writers can apply for an Amtrak fellowship.
Oh, I have read about that.
And
yeah.
You write, you plot your trip, and you could say, I want to go from Chicago to LA to Miami to New York and back to Chicago. Here's the big loop I'm going to take, and I'm going to write the whole way. And Amtrak will help fund that, which I think is fascinating.
Read about that. Well, some musicians I know, they do, instead of, you know, they have music cruises now, they do it on a train. It's called the Roots on the Rails tour.
Ooh.
And they go from, like, L.A. to Seattle. They did L.A. to Chicago.
That's
and,
fun.
Yeah, that I would want to do. I think it's about $4,000, though.
But trains are your thing. So
yeah.
You could have
flown almost every country I've wanted to see. I mean, yeah. There are others. I want to go to the North Pole. Kind of, Antarctica, I'd like to see that, too.
Okay. So basically what we've just arrived at is that all of our bucket list things are pretty attainable. I mean, for you know, relatively. None of them are millions of dollars things.
We have small imaginations, maybe. Well, we've got a call on the line. I don't know if you want to put on Mena.
All right.
He's got one that seems less attainable to
okay,
me.
Okay, great.
We'll see.
Hi, Mena. You're on WGN.
Hey, well, thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate that. It's great to talk about. There's just some really great things out there. And I just love space. I really
Ooh.
Do. And there's I love it. Well, if you want to be a space traveler, it's about $50 million, so that's way out most
right.
people's budget. But Virgin Galactic has a flight that actually goes, it's an hour flight, which is a three-day preparation. And I think you go 63 miles up, it's an hour flight, you actually go into weightlessness. And that's a little bit more attainable, but still pretty much out of budgets for about $250,000.
Wow.
So I think that'd be kind of fun to do, because you really, I think you can get to the point where you can see the globe, you know, the Earth, the roundness of the Earth. You get up so high, you can see the just beautiful. It's almost like you're right below space. So it's really exciting. So that'd be kind of fun to do.
Okay, that's pretty cool. That would be pretty cool. I hope that $250,000 drops into your lap so that you can do that.
Well, $50 million, right?
I don't think it'll ever happen, but certainly it'd be fun. So
yeah, that's a great one. That's a really good call. Well, thanks very much for the call. Have a great Saturday.
Thank you, Amy. Bye now.
All right, bye. Oh, that's a great idea.
Waitlist would be cool.
Waitlist would be cool. Being up high enough to see the, you know, the curve of the Earth, that'd be pretty cool. But you know when, like, remember when Felix Baumgartner jumped from space?
Mm-hmm.
That was scary to watch. You know, that just seemed like what, you know, it's one thing to go up in a ship because you're, you know, protected and it's the stuff that lets us not think about heights when we're flying in a, you know, commercial aircraft. But seeing him up there in that capsule, it was like, oh, this is, he is extremely vulnerable right now. This could go really badly. But I thought that was so interesting that he, you know, that he does that. See, I like things like that, though, that's kind of a one-off.
Right.
You know, who else can do that? I mean, he's, if you Google him, I mean, look at him on YouTube, he's done some crazy stuff, like jumped off the Patronus Towers and, you know, crazy things like that I think are kind of cool.
I'd want to go on a supersonic plane, actually, because you can't do it anymore. The Concorde doesn't fly.
Yeah.
That would have been
cool.
Yeah. But there are supersonic planes, so maybe just someone hitch me.
I want to leave space for our caller to go to space. I'm going to leave space for him. I mean, that would be cool, but I'm going to leave that for him. I don't know. I'm going to stick with shark cage. I just think that would be so neat to be submerged in this aquatic, you know, see, like in the ocean, seeing sharks around you in a protected way that they weren't going to bite you in half.
So we're either going up or
right.
down.
It's the two frontiers is really where, I mean, because that's like what else is left? Everything else seems so attainable.
I guess so. I don't want to do either of those things at all.
Well, so
it's very scary.
Here's kind of a related topic that I recently heard someone say. We were talking about, like, this person was in a conversation about how, like, 360 video is potentially altering travel and the idea of like, oh, I feel like I'm there because I'm able to look at your video and turn all the way around and see exactly what it looks like to be on this, you know, it's standing in below the Eiffel Tower or whatever. And the people talking were a little bit younger, a lot younger. But there was like a sense of you barely even have to travel anymore. You can do it all virtually, which I don't agree. I don't agree at all. I think you can see it, but you need to experience
can't
it.
Smell it. Can't
yeah.
Touch it.
I think there's something valuable about being in another country, especially if you do not have a language in common and just navigating. I think there's something very helpful to your psyche and your confidence that happens.
And the coffee's better in Europe, too. It's just better.
It's all about bananas in South Africa, I'm telling you. The most delicious
they
bananas.
They have better bananas.
Oh, my gosh.
But the caterpillars.
And the point of traveling is partially to go somewhere else, but also to get away from where you are.
So to gain perspective.
You miss out on
that
first part if you're just
right.
in a 360 video.
I would be very sad if traveling became reduced to what does this look like? I'm going to spin it around on my cell phone.
Yeah, anytime you get into talk like that about the future of technology and what it will change, it all seems so far off. Although, that's probably not true, but
right,
it's hard to imagine. I have a hard time buying people that say that's going to really keep people from traveling.
It will be interesting to see what things like augmented reality, 360 video, you know, what all of that will do to bucket lists. Maybe things won't seem quite as amazing, or maybe new frontiers of stuff will open up. I don't know. It'll be interesting to think about. But I think what we've realized today is that to get things off my bucket list, I think I cap out at about $250.
$250.
I think that's what it costs.
To the place with the sharks first.
That's true. That's true. There are no sharks right here in Lake Michigan.
That I know.
So, you know, find a tropical place where there are sharks and then get in the shark cage. That's about $250. So.
Or bring the sharks to you.
No, I don't need that.
Shed aquarium.
Infest the. Yeah, oh, there you go.
You can swim with, like, belugas and dolphins at the shed, which is kind of interesting. So.
So if you just slide a little money under the table. Say, you're already doing this anyway. Get me in there with the sharks,
What's
though.
Up, Shed Aquarium? Let's do this.
You're a journalist. You can do all this stuff the sake of story.
For the sake
you do
of
not have
journalism.
To pay for
Gonzo, yeah.
I mean, that's how George Plimpton lived his life. He did all kinds of cool stuff.
I'm happy to pay $250 to be with sharks. It's fine with me. I don't need to bribe anybody at the shed or exercise, whip out a media credential for it. It's all good. Well, it's an interesting thought, right? So I think it's something we should all kind of reflect on. What is it we would be willing to pay to get something off our bucket list? And then if it's something attainable, why the heck haven't we done it? Because, right, we only live once and we got to make the best of it. Indeed. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, and then turn you over to King John in just a bit here on 720 WGN.